When Zuger's best arguments made no dent on Clinton's resolve, Zuger went to Robin in her cabin. "You seem to have some influence on the fellow. Can you not persuade him, Sissy?" "Zuger, why are you so determined to prevent Captain Codrington defending his honour? He's a likeable enough chap, and I do not wish to see him pipped. And if he were, you might find it difficult to reach Quellamane. Is that not so?" Robin asked sweetly. "Your concern is most Christian. St. John can choose which of his eyes he will put a ball into. You've seen him shoot." Zuger ignored the accusation. "I believe it is Captain Codrington's duty to destroy that monster. God protects the righteous." "In my experience, he protects only those who shoot fastest and straightest," Zuger growled with frustration. "That is blasphemy," Robin told him. "You deserve to hear some real blasphemy for your stubbornness," Zuger told her curtly, and strode out of the cabin. He had learned through long experience when he was wasting his time. They passed the mouth of the Kai River, the frontier of British influence, and beyond it was the wilderness, unclaimed and untamed, peopled by the tribes which had been driven back inexorably by the white advance, and by scattered bands of renegades and bastards, wandering hunters and hardy travellers and traders. Even the trekking Boers had bypassed this land, going on into the interior, circling out beyond the mountain massif that divided the littoral from the highland plateau. Far to the north they had turned back and crossed the mountains again and reached the coast, fighting and shattering the impis of the Zulu nation, beginning to settle the fertile coastal strip until the British ships had sailed into Port Natal, following them up from the Cape Colony, from whence they had trekked so long and so hard to avoid British rule. The Boers had loaded their wagons once more, and driving their herds before them, climbed back over the range that they called the Dragon Mountains, and abandoned the land they had wrested from the Zulu king Dingaan, with the flame and smoke of their muskets. However, this coast along which Black Joke now steamed lay between the English colonies of Cape and Natal, claimed by none, except the wild tribesmen who watched the black-hulled vessel pass almost within arrow shot. Clinton Codrington had marked the point where latitude 31 degrees, 38 minutes south, intersected the coast, and the estuary was shown on the chart with the notation St. John's River, named, probably, by one of the early Portuguese navigators. But it was ironic that it should bear the same name as the man they were hastening to meet. When Black Joke steamed around the last headland, the description that St. John had given of his namesake was instantly recognisable. Steep, heavily wooded hills rose almost sheer about a wide lagoon. The forest was very dense, dark green, with tall galleries of trees, festooned with lianas. Through the telescope could be made out the troops of little grey vervet monkeys and the brilliant plumage of exotic birds that sported and fluttered through the top branches. The river came down a deep rocky gorge, torn through the barrier of hills, filling the reed-lined lagoon, and then flowing out over the bar between the curved white pillows of a sandy beach. To dispel any doubt that this was the rendezvous, Huron lay at anchor, a cable's length beyond the first line of breakers, in the deep, where the shoal water turned from pale green to blue. Clinton Codrington examined her carefully through his telescope, then, without a word, passed the instrument to Zuger. While he, in turn, glassed the big clipper, Clinton asked softly, "Will you act for me?" Zuger lowered the glass with surprise. "I expected one of your own officers." "I could not ask them," Clinton shook his head. "Slogger Kemp would mark their service records if he ever heard of it." "You do not have the same qualms about my career," Zuger pointed out. "You are on an extended absence from your regiment, and you have not been expressly ordered, as I and my officers have been." Zuger thought quickly. Dueling was not so seriously considered in the army as it was in the Royal Navy. In fact, the army manual still contained no express prohibitions, and a chance to meet with St. John was also a last chance to avert this ridiculous affair that so seriously threatened the continuance of his expedition. "I accept, then," Zuger said shortly. "I am extremely grateful to you, sir," said Clinton as shortly. Let us hope that you are as grateful after the business is over, Zuga told him dryly. I had best go across to Huron right away. It'll be dark in an hour. Tipu caught the line as it was thrown from the gunboat's whaler, and held it while Zuga gathered his cloak and jumped the gap of surging green water to the boarding ladder, clambering up before the next swell could soak his boots. Mungo St. John waited for him at the foot of the mainmast. He held himself unsmiling and aloof until Zuga hurried to him and offered his right hand. Then he relaxed and returned the smile. Damn it, Mungo, cannot we make an end to this nonsense?
Certainly, Zuga, Mungo St. John agreed. An apology from your man would settle it.
The man is a fool, Zuga shook his head. Why take the risk?
I don't consider there is any risk, but let me remind you, he called me a coward.
There is no chance, then? The two of them had become good friends during the weeks they had spent together, and Zuga felt he could press further.
I admit the fellow is a prig, but if you kill him, you'll make it damned awkward for me, don't you know?
Mungo St. John threw back his head and laughed delightedly.
You and I could work together. Do you know that, Zuga? You are a pragmatist, like I am. I make a prophecy. You'll go a long way in this world.
Not very far if you kill the man who is taking me. And Mungo St. John chuckled again and clapped a friendly hand upon his shoulder.
I'm sorry, my friend. Not this time.
And Zuga sighed with resignation.
You have choice of weapons.
Pistols, said Mungo St. John.
Of course, Zuga nodded.
Dawn tomorrow on the beach there, he pointed to the land with his chin. Will that suit you?
Admirably. Tipo here will act for me.
Does he understand the conventions? Zuga asked doubtfully, as he glanced at the half-naked figure that waited near at hand.
He understands enough to blow Codrington's head off at the shoulders if he levels his pistol a moment before the signal.
Mungo St. John flashed that cruel white smile.
And that's all he needs to know, as far as I'm concerned.
Robin Ballantyne slept not a minute during the night, and it still lacked 2 hours of dawn when she bathed and dressed. On an impulse, she chose her old moleskin breeches and man's woolen jacket. There would be the need to disembark through the surf from the ship's boats, and skirts would hamper her, added to which the morning was damp and chill, and her jacket was of good thick Scottish tweed. She laid out her black leather bag and checked its contents, making certain she had everything she needed to cleanse and staunch a bullet wound, to bind up torn flesh or hold together shattered bone, and to reduce the agony of either man. All of them had taken it without question that Robin would be on the beach that morning. The gunboat did not rate a surgeon, and neither did Huron. She was ready with an hour to wait, and she opened her journal and began making the previous day's entry, when there was a light tap on her door. When she opened it, Clinton Codrington stood in the opening, his face pale and strained in the smoky lamplight, and she knew intuitively that he had slept as little as she had. He recovered swiftly from the first shock of seeing her in breeches, dragging his eyes up to her face again.
I hoped I might speak with you, he muttered shyly. It will be the last opportunity before...
She took his arm and drew him into the cabin.
You have not breakfasted? She asked sternly.
No, ma'am. He shook his head, and his eyes dropped to her trousered legs, and then jerked up guiltily to her face again.
The medicine worked? She asked.
He nodded, too embarrassed to reply. She had administered a purge the evening before, for as a surgeon, she could dread the effects of a pistol ball through a full bowel, or through a belly loaded with breakfast. She touched his forehead.
You are warm.
You have not taken a chill?
She felt protective towards him, like a mother almost, for he seemed once again so young and untried.
I wondered if we might pray together. His voice was so low that she barely caught the words, and she felt a warm, almost suffocating rush of affection for him.
Come, she whispered.
and she took his hand. They knelt together on the bare deck of the tiny cabin, still holding hands, and she spoke for both of them, and he made the responses in a soft but firm voice. When they rose stiffly at last, he kept her hand in his for a while longer. Dr. Ballantyne, I cannot tell you now what a profound effect meeting you has had on my life. She felt herself blushing and tried feebly to disengage her hand, but he clung to it. I would like to have your permission to talk to you again in this vein afterwards, he paused, if this morning goes as we hope it will. Oh, it will, she said fiercely. It will, I know it will. Hardly knowing what she was doing, she pressed herself swiftly to him and reached up, kissed him full on the mouth. For a moment he froze, and then clumsily he crushed her to him so that the brass buttons of his coat dug into her bosom and his teeth crushed her lips until she felt them bruising. My darling, he whispered. Oh, my darling. The strength of his reaction startled her, but almost immediately she found she was enjoying the strength of his embrace, and she tried to free her arms to return it. But he misunderstood her movements and released her hurriedly. Forgive me, he blurted out. I don't know what came over me. Her disappointment was sharp enough to turn instantly to annoyance at his timidity. Buttons and teeth notwithstanding, it had felt very pleasant indeed. Both boats left the two ships at the same time, and they converged through the thin, pearly morning mist as their crews pulled for the low lines of breaking surf and the pale outline of the beach in the dawn. They landed within 100 yards of each other, surfing in on the crest of the same low green wave, and the oarsmen leapt out waist-deep to run the boats high up the white sand. Both parties moved separately over the crest of the sandbar and then down to the edge of the lagoon, screened from the boat crews by the intervening dunes and the stands of tall, fluffy-headed reeds. There was a level area of firm, damp sand at one edge of the reeds. Mungo, St. John and Tipo halted at one end, and Mungo lit a cheroot and stood with both hands on his hips, staring out at the crests of the hills, ignoring the activity about him. He was dressed in black, tight-fitting breeches and a white silk shirt with full sleeves, open at the throat to reveal the dark curls of his body hair. The white shirt would give his opponent a fair aiming point. He was observing the convention scrupulously. Robin watched him covertly as she stood beside Clinton Codrington at the further end of the clearing. She tried to capture the hatred she felt for St. John, to hold on to her outrage at the way he had abused her. But it was a difficult emotion to sustain. Rather, she was excited, and with a strange sense of elation, the satanic presence of this man heightened the feeling. She caught herself staring openly and dragged her eyes off him. Beside her, Clinton stood very erect. He wore his blue uniform jacket with the gold lace of his rank gleaming even in the soft pink light of early dawn. He had scraped the sun-bleached hair back from his forehead and temples and bound it at the nape of his neck, leaving clean the purposeful line of his jaw. Zuga went forward to meet Tipu, who carried under his arm the rosewood case of pistols. When they met in the centre of the level ground, he opened the case and proffered it, standing straddle-legged and attentive, while Zuga took each weapon from its velvet nest and loaded it with a carefully measured charge of black powder before ramming home the dark blue leaden ball and setting the cap on the nipple. The sight of the long-barreled weapons reminded Robin forcefully of that night aboard Huron, and she bit her lip and shifted uncomfortably. "Do not fret yourself, Miss Ballantyne." Clinton mistook her emotion and whispered soothingly to comfort her while he unbuttoned his jacket and shrugged out of it. Beneath it, he also wore a plain white shirt to give St. John a fair aim. He handed her the jacket and would have spoken again, but Zuga called. "Will the principals come forward?" And Clinton gave her another tightly strained smile before he strode out, his heels leaving deep prints in the damp yellow sand.